Today on Against the Grain, what use is utopian thinking? Is hope something we need to cultivate or rediscover? I'm CS. John Greenaway talks about the philosophy and politics of the German thinker Ernst Bloch, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Ernst Bloch was a German philosopher and utopian thinker who lived from 1885 to 1972. He wrote books with titles like The Principle of Hope and The Spirit of Utopia. Scholars and activists today find themselves drawn to Bloch's understanding of history, human consciousness, revolution, Marxism, religion, and fascism. John Greenaway, a writer and researcher who covers politics, culture, horror, and theory, has written a new book about Bloch. It's titled A Primer on Utopian Philosophy, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Ernst Bloch. When John and I connected recently, they began with these remarks about hope.
There's a poem by the German communist and playwright Bertolt Brecht that I like to quote quite a lot when talking about Bloch. It's the poem To Posterity, and it opens with Brecht saying, "Truly, I live in dark times." And it goes on to say, "These are dark times because a conversation about trees is almost a crime because it implies silence about so many other things." And I feel like that's a good expression of how people think about talking about this philosophical and political idea of a better world, right? In the midst of all of the many unfolding crises that we sort of have to live through and endure as best we can, it's very easy to think of talking about utopia or utopianism as naive escapism at the best, and maybe even being an abnegation of our political responsibilities at the very worst. But I wanted to try and make the argument that in the midst of those dark times, you know, Brecht was writing in the 20s and 30s in the rise of European fascism. Lots of his friends left his country, left his home. Those were truly dark times, but there was also an explosion in thinking seriously about what grounds our sense that the world can be radically different from how it is. So the book opens by talking about the election of Barack Obama in 2008. And for so many people, that's a deeply meaningful moment. That was a very hopeful moment. And I think there is an awareness that that hope was very unfulfilled. And rather than try and be cynical about hope, the aim of this new, very short, hopefully very accessible book is to try and take hope seriously.
And when you talk about hope, what do you see as a relationship between hope and utopianism? Are they synonyms, or is a certain kind of hope in your mind associated with utopian thinking?
Yeah, so very often people think of hope as just a feeling. You know, we feel hope when things are going well, when good things are happening to us or to the people that we love and care for. For Bloch, hope is a philosophical principle that is evidenced in all of human history. It's evidenced in existence and is something that determines and shapes a particular politics. And that politics is what Bloch would call the utopian process. So to kind of put a crude taxonomy onto things, it would be, there is a philosophy of hope and there is a politics of utopia.
So in other words, you see Bloch as doing both philosophy and politics, and perhaps seeing philosophy as sort of the foundation for a right-thinking politics?
I think that's a really good question. And so for Bloch, philosophy is not an abstract pursuit. Philosophy is not a scholastic exercise. It isn't something that's merely academic. For Bloch, philosophy is intimately connected with life. He wrote very beautifully and very movingly about music, about architecture, about literature, about theatre, and about political struggle. So if philosophy becomes removed from life, in a way it ceases to be philosophical for Bloch. So to think and to be engaged with philosophical arguments is to be fundamentally engaged in the field of politics already. But yes, he's very much doing philosophy as someone who has a specific set of philosophical commitments.
And what were those commitments with relation to the human condition? And I'm wondering here whether he believed that humans were missing something, were yearning for something absent in their lives.
This is key. This is absolutely key to Bloch's whole project. So politically, like many people in Germany at the time, he was unorthodox, but it was a committed Marxist and communist. But his best known book is probably something called The Principle of Hope. The original title for The Principle of Hope was going to be Dreams of a Better Life. And his kind of guiding principle was that within those dreams, you know, what we imagine, what we project forward into the future about ourselves is something very revealing about what it is that we want, the kind of life that we want to be living. So he thought that so much of what we sensed as missing in our lives, you know, our dissatisfactions, our needs, our desires, these were not just feelings, but they were in fact politically revealing of the state of the world that we lived in. You know, how many of us have found ourselves thinking about, oh no, I have to go to work tomorrow at this job that I don't like and it doesn't pay very well and the work that I do doesn't seem to be meaningful. Wouldn't it be great to have a job where I actually felt like I was making a difference in the world? And for Bloch, that isn't just an idle thought or a daydream. It's actually something that reveals a deep down political desire about us, because the whole kind of crux of his philosophy is to try and move this idea of hope away from those fleeting subjective moments and to give it a more secure philosophical base in the hope that it will help us to change the way that we live.
This focus on dreams and fantasies and daydreams, how did he, and maybe how would you square that with kind of the, maybe what people think of when they think of conventional Marxism with its focus on politics and economics and classes, not so much on individuals and individual self-realization?
I think this is a really, really important question. And it's something that makes Bloch a very distinctive thinker. He doesn't have much of a presence in the Anglophone world. I think people are very comfortable talking about figures like Theodor Adorno or Walter Benjamin or other kind of European intellectuals from that time. But pretty much all of them were in some way writing with or writing against or writing in response to Bloch. So Bloch, in The Principle of Hope, talks about two, not traditions, but I suppose we could call them approaches to the question, and he divides this into the cold stream of Marxism and the warm stream of Marxism. And the cold stream is exactly what you were just talking about, you know, sociological inquiry, the science of dialectical materialism, a big focus on economics. And on the other hand, you have what Bloch saw as the warm stream, and this, he said, was prophetic, it was humanistic. It was very concerned with the emancipation of the individual. And it also had a pre-Marxist history, you know, movements for religious emancipation. He was deeply interested in theology and religion. These were all part of this warm stream of Marxism. And Bloch said, actually, you have to have both. You have to have both of these approaches to the question, because if all you have is that warm stream of Marxism that's very prophetic, it's very future-facing, he said, you end up with people who want to take revenge upon the world, right? He said it leads to, as he put it, it leads to Jacobinism. And then he said, if you only have the cold stream that doesn't speak to the imagination, that has no interest in culture, has no way of speaking to people's dreams and hopes, you end up with something that is reformist, that gets lost in the mists, as he put it. These two positions, these two kind of styles of thought are not contradictory for Bloch. He says, actually, it's crucial that there is a political movement that allows for a very clear and very clinical understanding of society, but also takes the dreams and desires and hopes and fears of that society, of culture, very seriously.
That's the voice of John Greenaway. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. We are talking about John's new book, A Primer on Utopian Philosophy, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Ernst Bloch. Bloch was a philosopher, communist, utopian, and writer born in 1885. Interesting what you said about Bloch's affinities with religion. Because, of course, you know, Marxism is identified with hostility toward religion. And one could talk about the realms of dreams and longings and yearnings without bringing up religion. Talk more about why Bloch, if he were not necessarily a believer, why he felt himself drawn to religion and wrote about it.
Yeah, so one of Bloch's books that has been translated into English is called Atheismus in Christianity, or Atheism in Christianity. And you're quite right to say that historically Marxism has been very skeptical of religion theology. But I think Bloch's response would be, well, it's simply out of ignorance in some ways. So Bloch wrote this book and analyzed particularly Christianity as having within it a story of liberation. Because the stories of liberation, of the Exodus story, of a new heaven and a new earth, the Gospels being full of incidences of Jesus overturning established rules and societies, these are kind of fuel for an imaginative capacity to think about a world that could be different. So Bloch was a materialist. He didn't believe in anything close to a transcendent deity, but he also thought that belief was not simply something that could be wished away and had to be engaged with. As he puts it in his book, Atheism in Christianity, only an atheist can be a good Christian, and only a Christian can be a good atheist. If you take seriously this idea of liberation, you will inevitably, Bloch thought, be led to the conclusion that that liberation is not some kind of far-off paradise that will arrive if you're good, but is something that can be brought into the here and now. He sees that his job is to kind of, as he puts it, to kind of liberate the rational kernel from within the irrational shell of religion. He didn't want everybody to, you know, to start believing in some transcendent deity that exists, you know, beyond the realms of existence, but to see themselves as kind of continuing a story of a move from a humanity that is enslaved to a humanity that could be free. And this is something that is best accomplished in his philosophy through revolutionary political struggle. You know, this is what he means when he says if you are a good Christian, you will eventually end up as an atheist, because you'll realize that your own salvation and your own transformation of the world involves redeeming all of the world. And I think it's incredibly important that religion is a field that is not left to kind of reactionary forces where oppressive hierarchies and exploitation can be naturalized by it being explained as kind of God's will. And Bloch's work is a really impressive kind of subversion of a lot of reductionist left ideas about religion that I think many more people should be aware of.
You write of Ernst Bloch's belief that elements of the still-to-come utopia, the kingdom of God in religious terms, are already here, already present in some form. Elaborate on that. Where did Bloch see these elements as being present or as emerging?
So Bloch uses the term Vorschein in German, or the, quite literally, the pre-appearance. And the big space that Bloch turned to, well, there are two that I think are very worth highlighting here, is that he believed that culture, firstly, had a utopian element to it, and secondly, history. So there is a kind of idea that history has a kind of universality to it, that there's a smooth teleology, that capitalism seems inevitable, that things were always going to kind of shake out this way. And one of Bloch's famous terms is, I suppose in English, the closest translation would be non-synchronicity. As he puts it, we don't all live in the same now. Try as it might, capitalism cannot make itself completely universal, right? Precisely because it depends upon constant renewal. And Bloch took very seriously this idea that actually in history, there are these moments of rupture and moments of possibility when things could have been otherwise. And they contain within them these kind of useful catalysts for our own kind of understanding of where we are. So Frederick Jameson, who I quote in this book, wrote back in the 70s, maybe one of the first substantial English language introductions to Bloch. And he talks about history and says that the point of being a utopian who studies history is not to find out what really happened, but to destabilize what we think we know about history, to show that there were all of these possibilities where things could have been otherwise, where moments of rupture and of change were either co-opted or were kind of deliberately snuffed out. Bloch also says that there's these utopian elements in philosophy, but like philosophy is not the ground in which we kind of construct a utopian future. He says that actually happens when we take both the past and culture seriously as having political valence, you know, denaturalizing, quote unquote, just the way things are. And we recognize our own capacity, our own potential.
In Ernst Bloch's book, The Principle of Hope, he, among other things, tries to excavate all of history. It's a very ambitious project and a very big book. And to find traces of the not yet conscious. What sorts of things, specific things, does he point to as he looks back into history and sees seeds or tendencies that could have been expressed and maybe weren't, but point the way possibly to a better future for us?
This is a really good question. So The Principle of Hope is an enormous book. In English, it runs to about three volumes. It's 1,600 pages. It took a decade to write. And what doesn't he cover? He covers kind of all of human culture. So In The Principle of Hope, in the first volume, Bloch talks about sort of relics of high culture from the past and tries to sort of figure out why do they retain this power to kind of interest us when the conditions and the society that produced those things has kind of completely passed away. He's talking about things like the Acropolis, Strasbourg Cathedral, Aristotle's Ethics. To quote Bloch directly, all great cultural works have implicitly, though not always explicitly, a utopian background. They are now, from the point of view of that philosophical concept of utopia, not an ideological prank of a higher kind, but the attempted path and content of known hope. There is a spirit of utopia in the final predicate of every great statement. In Strasbourg Cathedral, and in the Divine Comedy, in the expectant music of Beethoven, and in the latencies of the Mass in B minor. Bloch is a very beautiful writer, and I think that's a really good example of what you were talking about. That the ways in which kind of high culture has been handed down to us often, I think, kind of obscures its radical potential. I think in the quote that I read there, Dante's Divine Comedy is a really good example of this. So I think what makes Bloch exciting to read is that he has this potential to kind of radically reshape how you think about everything that you encounter. Great art showing us the possibility of a world that could be and isn't just like the realm of imagination. Those feelings of kind of intense emotional response when we listen to music. I like that he mentions Beethoven. He also wrote about Wagner quite a lot. So he wasn't just like interested in kind of high culture, but all of human culture he saw as kind of having within it either implicitly or explicitly this desire for a better world. I think a really good modern example of this is the British writer Mark Fisher. He talks about this idea of popular modernism, where popular culture in the 60s, 70s and 80s of the 20th century was popular, two, it was intellectual, and three, it was always kind of looking towards the future. There was very little nostalgia in it. And I think that's a really good place to start to think about how we might see those utopian possibilities in the culture that we find ourselves surrounded by now.
I'm speaking with John Greenaway about their new book about the philosophy of Ernst Bloch, the 20th century philosopher, utopian communist. John's new book is A Primer on Utopian Philosophy. They co-host the podcast Horror Vanguard, and John can be found online under the handle The Lit Crit Guy. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I mentioned that Ernst Bloch was born in 1885 in Germany, eventually made his way to Berlin, targeted by the Nazis, moved to the U.S. in 1938, stayed for about 10 years, then returned to Germany to teach and build socialism. That's a super simplistic survey of his life. What else do you want to say about his life trajectory in the sense of kind of how he came to his ideas of utopianism and Marxism and his general worldview?
So yes, he's born in a small town called Ludwigshafen, which is a sort of working class, relatively poor town. And it's just across the river from a very beautiful town called Mannheim. And there is this divide, this non-synchronicity is a very early and very vivid kind of formative influence on Bloch. So he comes of age in a really interesting time in German culture. He's surrounded by the artistic movements of Expressionism. He reads Tolstoy, he reads Dostoevsky, he reads Nietzsche. And initially, as a young man, he sort of thinks that Marxism is too deterministic. It's too teleological. And that's maybe something that he always kind of struggles with in his own writing, is an overcommitment to that. He falls in with the Hungarian philosopher Georgi Lukács, who later would become a much more kind of militant, a much more orthodox Marxist than would be part of the Hungarian communist government. But Bloch ends up in Harvard during the Second World War. He speaks very little German. He speaks very little English, rather, and he writes The Principle of Hope, often very isolated from other émigrés from Europe. There is a very fun but possibly apocryphal story that because of his known communist sympathies, he was asked to regularly report to immigration officers. And the fun story is that he was asked at a citizenship test to explain the causes of the American Revolution, and sort of the examiners listening completely enraptured as he gives this great historical survey. But he then moves back to East Germany and falls foul in many ways of an increasingly sort of Stalinist turn in socialist politics. He is denounced as a mystic and a revisionist. And in 1961, he remains in West Germany when the Berlin Wall goes up. And in a way, he is this kind of philosopher who is out of place almost always. So in East Germany, he's too revisionist. He's too interested in religion. In West Germany, he's too much of a communist to be trusted. And he settles at the University of Tübingen when he's given an honorary chair in philosophy. When he's well into his 60s, it's his first proper academic position. He's known personally as someone with a great deal of integrity, although personally I think he is almost unforgivably slow to reckon with the consequences of 1956, when there's the famous speech by Khrushchev. But he is an extraordinary thinker. As a stylist, I think he's one of the best philosophical writers of the 20th century. His style is kind of expressionist and very modernist. He's a very literary writer, and it doesn't feel like you're reading something that's quite dry and abstract.
John, who or what sector of society does Ernst Bloch see doing utopian activity? Does he see anchoring the pursuit of utopian and revolutionary aims?
Well, again, I think it's really important to stress that Bloch, by his critics, Bloch is this mystic, you know, an almost a semi-religious writer. But he is immensely philosophically sophisticated and very politically committed. And so his commitment is always to the laboring, dreaming, striving mass that is the working classes. Utopia is not this kind of like naive universalism. There's an essay by the British writer China Mieville that I really like that includes the famous line, we already live in a utopia. It just isn't one for us. And, you know, the answer to that, China Mieville says, is that we must learn to hope with teeth, which is a great sort of poetic image. And it's one that I think Bloch would entirely agree with. Utopia is the site brought about by the unfolding processes of a revolutionary working class movement. Now, in some ways, you can make criticisms of this in Bloch's philosophy, but he was someone who lived through and was deeply shaped by the Russian Revolution, and this idea that actually the working classes could assume power and did have revolutionary potential. But he was also not this kind of doctrinaire thinker. So there's a phrase in Latin that Bloch was very fond of, where he says, the process will be made by the people who are made by the process. So this process of revolution is made by the people who are also shaped by that process in which they are participants and agents. So he doesn't think that utopia is this kind of, it's not a place, or it's not a party or a kind of program that the right set of politics will get you to, but rather it's this unfolding historical and political process that is driven by the agent of history, which is working class struggle.
So you write that the standard objection to utopia rests upon three criticisms. I'm going to read a little bit here from your book. Firstly, the nature of things, we're mentioning the three criticisms here. First, the nature of things is just given. Second, utopia is not here and now, but located somewhere else. And finally, and you write perhaps most worryingly, utopianism leads to a kind of psychological subjectivism. Anything you want to add to those three criticisms, or, you know, the way they are identified? And I'm wondering what you see Ernst Bloch, how you see him as responding to those three criticisms.
And I think maybe I can kind of just keep going if we're reading a little from the book, if that's okay. So Bloch's response is essentially to deny the premise of each of those things. So this idea that actually the state of things is just given, right? The world is the way it is. You have to grow up and stop being so utopian. And Bloch would say, actually, no, the world is not just the way that it is, because even the very stuff of existence is not just some inert lump, but is something that is constantly in flux, right? The world itself is not simply a kind of fixed, static object. Secondly, the other premise is utopia is not here and now. As Bloch puts it himself, there is no realism worthy of the name which abstracts from this strongest element in reality as something which is unfinished. Reality is not yet completed, right? There is still kind of scope within the world for us to act. The final point, this idea of the kind of psychological subjectivism of utopianism. So again, if I can read from the book. For Bloch, this is perhaps at best only half true, but is an undialectical criticism which ignores the ways in which utopia has a heuristic function, uncovering new ideas, new possibilities, and new modes of life. These new modes of life should not be discounted simply because they represent a break from what we take to be just the way things are. Utopia is a philosophical and ontological rupture, and it is a damning indictment of our own current imaginative and intellectual malnourishment that such a rupture is for many quite literally unthinkable. There is a very famous quote that kind of gets thrown around in a lot of left circles, that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. It's attributed to Frederick Jameson or to Slavoj Žižek, but it's made most famous, I think, by Mark Fisher. And I think the Blochian response is that if that's true, we have a lot of work to do on our imaginative capacity.
Right. The realm of imagination, and here we come back to Bloch's focus on culture and on human subjectivity, individual subjectivity. Imagination has to be changed. So I'm guessing Bloch felt that the radical imagination had been suppressed or repressed, and that there was something lacking in people's ability to imagine a better world, to imagine forward a future of liberatory possibilities?
I think a really good way of taking on this question is to think of a kind of, on the one hand, we have hope. And so what is the opposite of hope? And Bloch would say the answer to that question is not fear. Fear is not the opposite of hope. The opposite of hope is nostalgia or memory. Because hope, for Bloch, is irreducibly about the future. This notion of, like, what is it that you hope for is something that is yet to arrive. But rather, like, nostalgia is, it's all about getting us to look backwards, which militates against our capacities to kind of take our own imaginative and political agency into our own hands. So memory and nostalgia are, for Bloch, kind of like the antithesis of hope. I think a really good example of this is like the dominance in contemporary popular culture of like Marvel movies over the past decade or so, that's reached a point of cultural saturation where it's always like, you know, the ever familiar hero comes to restore the status quo, right? That's always the kind of like philosophical underpinnings of a lot of these films. There is no great rupture. And even if there is a great rupture, it can be completely smoothed back over. And what you get is not kind of hope in popular culture. You get this kind of like easy to consume, easy to produce, easy to distribute, kind of passive nostalgia.
You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. John Greenaway, that's J-O-N, Greenaway, joins me. They are a writer and researcher who covers horror, politics, culture, and theory. Their books include Theology, Horror, and Fiction, a reading of the Gothic 19th Century. We are talking about John's new book, A Primer on Utopian Philosophy, an Introduction to the Philosophy of Ernst Bloch. And again, Bloch was born in 1885 and was a utopian, a communist, so-called atheist theologian, and a philosopher. Let's talk about Ernst Bloch's notion of the conscious and the unconscious. So Freud came up, of course, with the extremely influential notion of the unconscious. And Ernst Bloch, as you write, focused on the liberatory and revolutionary possibilities of the not yet conscious coming into being. How does the not yet conscious differ from Freud's unconscious?
I think this is really an important point. So Bloch was relatively unsympathetic to Freud. Freud, he thought, made the mistake of putting us back into our own pasts. He said that he was interested in daydreams because daydreams are about the future. The dreams at night, they're always about the past. You know, you're always taken back into yourself, into memory. That's the ground of the Freudian unconscious. So a very important philosophical phrase that Bloch uses throughout his work is the not yet, the nicht noch da, which is not easily translated in a straightforward sense into English, but a very good kind of analogy would be, you know, the seed is not yet a flower. And it would be wrong to see a seed and go, oh, well, that's a flower, right? But at the same time, everything that the flower is and will become is contained as a kind of potentiality within the seed. So the seed is not yet the flower. And so this is Bloch's notion that certain things have yet to come to fruition. You know, the working class, the proletariat is not yet revolutionary, but the potentialities of that revolutionary aspect are present within the here and now. And so the job of the utopian philosopher for Bloch was to be attuned to the those moments when the not yet can be found, the idea that there are these latencies within the present which have yet to be kind of fully actualized.
And many people looking for these latencies will butt up against the wall that they observe, that they perceive of capitalist hegemony, right? That capitalism is so strong and so overwhelming and so ubiquitous, how can we think beyond it? How can we realistically hope beyond it? Now, much of what you've said about Bloch, in some sense, predicts what you're going to say in response to this question, but what does or what did Bloch think of this notion that capitalist hegemony is complete and we have really no realistic way of escaping it?
I think Bloch would say it's defeatist, and what we need is kind of new weaponry. And history, he said, is both it's not just an archive, but is a weapon. So in November of 1961, at the University of Tübingen, Bloch gave a public lecture. And the title of the lecture was "Can Hope Be Disappointed?" And he says this: even a well-founded hope can be disappointed. Otherwise, it would not be hope. In fact, hope never guarantees anything. It is daring and points openly to possibilities that, in part, depend on chance for their fulfillment. Hope can be frustrated and thwarted, but out of the frustrations and disappointment, it can learn to estimate the tendencies of processes that it had possibly estimated incorrectly. Hope can learn and become smarter through damaging experiences, but it can never be driven off course. As he put it in the conclusion of that lecture, he says, "The world process has not yet been won anywhere, but also it has not been thwarted anywhere. And human beings can be on earth the indicators of their decisive way towards salvation that has not yet come, or towards damnation that has also not yet come. Hercules says, whoever does not hope for the unhoped for will not find it." And again, this is not to say that, you know, Bloch is quite clear that, like, utopia is not a given, right? It is not something that is inevitable. I think this makes the stakes of a potential future very high. This idea that we go, oh, well, there's nothing that we can do. We accept the worst and all we can hope for is a kind of managed decline, I think is unbelievably quietistic. It's an abandoning of a kind of like our responsibilities towards other people. But Bloch also gives the warning that, you know, the factors for winning are in some ways outside of our control. And perhaps that's maybe a bleak way of thinking about it, but In a paper I wrote recently, I sort of contrasted Ernst Bloch with Mark Fisher. And Fisher is often taken as someone who wrote about the extent of capitalist hegemony. But at the very end of the kind of final line of his famous book, Capitalist Realism, it says this: from a situation in which nothing is possible, suddenly anything is possible again. And I think it's very important for you know, us on the kind of contemporary left, the modern left, who have maybe absorbed a lot of this need to always be critiquing, always be kind of thinking about the kind of the extent to which things are very bleak in some ways, to remember that Fisher, of all people, who is so often caricatured as a miserabilist, had a utopian aspect to his thought. The idea that actually it doesn't take much to denaturalize the state of things. You know, as he puts it, there's this kind of gray curtain over our political imaginations, this sense of capitalist realism. But it's a realism which is entirely constructed, and it is changeable.
Ernst Bloch, he saw, experienced the rise of fascism in Germany. How did he explain fascism's success in that country, and how did his explanation differ from other commentators?
So one of Bloch's best books, I think, is called Heritage of Our Time in English. And this is essentially a sociological study of German society at the time of the rise of fascism, attempting to understand how fascism appealed to the hopes and dreams and imaginative drives and desires of every kind of strata of the society at the time. And at the time, quite a lot of people sort of dismissed the rise of fascism, particularly from the left. The arguments were something like, oh, it's a kind of trick of ideology. People are just believing the wrong thing. And so if the facts are explained to them, then, you know, they'll come around to see things our way. And Bloch wrote the book as a kind of way of going, actually, no. What's important to understand is that, as he put it, fascism is a swindle of revolution, right? It promises you that, you know, if you feel weak and exploited, it promises you that you're going to feel strong. If you feel ignored, it promises you that you're going to feel empowered. It tailors its message to speak to the hopes, dreams, and fears of entire cultural demographics. And I think the kind of crux of his argument is, like, this is why it's important not simply to have a correct economic analysis of how capitalism functions, but actually to understand that imagination and drives and desires are a political space in culture. And if that space is abnegated, if that space is kind of retreated from by the left wing, fascism will try and occupy it.
What's your sense of how Ernst Bloch would critique political and or philosophical utopianism today?
So in his long relationship with Adorno, another great German philosopher, they had many kind of debates over utopia and the concept of the term and the relevance of the term. And the two of them had almost diametrically opposed philosophical methodologies. Adorno is far more kind of negative. Bloch is very loquacious and positive and optimistic in some ways. But they both agreed upon utopia as this kind of necessity. And something that I say in the book is, and I think this is true, that really the challenge is not to say what is the kind of current state of utopian philosophy today. I think the situation is far worse than that. I think in a kind of general popular sense, to think about a radically different world is almost seen as impossible. You know, it isn't that we should have kind of hope. I think we have to hope for hope. And I don't mean that in kind of just a kind of subjective feeling, but to take seriously Bloch's notion of hope as having philosophical content. Hope has to be kind of revitalized. I think the question of philosophical utopianism has to be reopened. You know, utopia must be made thinkable again. And, you know, that's in some ways a much harder task than having the arguments over what kind of utopian philosophy are we talking about.
And what about utopianism in relation to Marxism today? Are there obstacles in your mind that stand in the way of reconciling Marxism and utopianism in the current moment?
I think if anything, we kind of have an opportunity today, actually, to do some very interesting work in this space. I think the recent resurgence of ecological socialism, of eco-socialism, of degrowth socialism, shows the ways in which the inevitable limits and catastrophes of capitalism can be thought through in very productive ways. Bloch was a Promethean. You know, he believed that actually we could attain a sort of mastery over the world. But I think if there is going to be a utopia beyond the world of extractive fossil capitalism, it's going to be one which is radically different from the world we currently inhabit. So Bloch used an analogy quite a lot that he said that Genesis lies at the end, not at the beginning. So the end of something is also the necessary precondition for the new to come into existence. And whether that quantitative and qualitative break with our current social and political and economic formations is very sudden or is gradual, relatively speaking, I think utopianism is not just kind of timely but necessary, right? If there is going to be any future that has a place for working class people, that has a place for kind of radical politics within it, it has to be one that takes this kind of legacy of Bloch's utopianism as an integral tool for thinking through the question of the future at all.
John Greenaway writes about politics, culture, and theory. You can check out their new book about Ernst Bloch. It's called A Primer on Utopian Philosophy, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Ernst Bloch, published by Zero Books. John, thanks very much for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. And I wanted to kind of finish by saying that for some people listening, this may have sounded quite abstract. It might have sounded quite, you know, academic. But I think taking seriously the idea of hope as a philosophical reality is one that is lived. It's a lived experience that in the midst of the kind of bleakness of the world, it isn't about turning away from that bleakness, but recognizing within that our own capacity, our own agency, our own, possibility. Our responsibility is to both look at and through the current state of things. We should be very aware of just how vast the challenges that face us are, but also that there is something better in this world that could be brought into being.
And we will close this hour with a song about hope amidst hard times. Written in 1918 by Ralph Chaplin, the song is called Commonwealth of Toil, and it has been revived by Matt Callahan and Yvonne Moore in their collection Working Class Heroes, A History of Struggle in Song. Here's Commonwealth of Toil.
In the gloom of mighty cities, mid the roar of whirling wheels, we are toiling on like chattel slaves of old. And our masters hope to keep us ever thus beneath their heels, and to coin our very lifeblood into gold. But we have a glowing dream of a fair the world will seem, when each one can live their life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor, and there's joy and peace for all, in the commonwealth of toil that is to be. They would keep us cowed and beaten, cringing meekly at their feet. They would stand between each worker and his bread. Shall we yield our lives up to them for the bitter crusts we eat? Shall we only hope for heaven when we're dead? But we have a glowing dream of a fair the world will seem, when each one can live their life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor, and there's joy and peace for all, in the commonwealth of toil that is to be. another end of time. Shall we stagger on beneath their heavy load? Or shall we let them live forever in their gilded halls of crime, with our children doomed to toil beneath their gold? But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when each one can live their life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor, and there's joy and peace for all in the commonwealth, the toil that is to be. When our cause is all triumphant, then we claim our Mother Earth, and the nightmare of the present fades away. We shall live with love and laughter, we who now are little worth, and will not regret the price we have to pay. We have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when each one can live their life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all in the commonwealth of toil that is to be.
Commonwealth of Toil by Ralph Chaplin, performed by Matt Callahan and Yvonne Moore. It's part of Working Class Heroes, a collection on CD of U.S. working class pre-World War II folk songs, revived by Callahan and Moore, and published by PM Press and Free Dirt Records. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.